Well, we've had an interesting night.
We sure have. We've just been interviewed by Feature Magazine. So thank you very much, Alex, and thank you very much for listening and being interested. And thank you, thank you.
Love your work, Alex. It was so much fun.
It was. I loved it. I loved talking about myself, obviously.
And podcasts.
And podcasts, yes.
Yes.
Because it's not all about me. Funny enough, it's not all about me.
It's a bit about you, though.
Okay. All right.
What does that look for?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
Oh, dear.
Yes. Yes.
Hello, everyone. Oh, hang on. Did I jump in too early?
You did. Okay. Pause. Damn. Gap. So I've got a nice little line to insert the theme song. And then we're good to go.
Are you giving away all our secrets?
We have secrets?
We thought we did. Okay.
Okay.
Sorry, everyone. Go on.
Yee. What the? History. Hello and welcome to What the History, your fortnightly taste of tasty bits of tasty bizarre history that's tasty.
Nom noms.
I am one of your hosts, Trevor Holland, and of course I am joined by...
Susie Holland. Hello, everyone.
And
again.
Absolutely. And I want to say we've got a bit of an empowering episode tonight, so we probably should move on through. And what do you have for us this fortnight, Susie?
Okay, I've got an interesting story here about the Hatpin Warriors. Okay, now as the title conjures up, women fending off people with hat pins, maybe using them as swords to slash and jab would-be attackers, and you wouldn't be far wrong. How did the humble hat pin become a weapon? What was the catalyst? And more importantly, why were they needed against the mashers? And what is a masher? Listen on, dear people, listen on.
Sounds like a start of a musical.
Could be. Mm. Oh, what a great idea. I don't know. Andrew Lloyd Webber, we are taking ideas. Can we pitch an idea to you? And Mr. Rice, even though you're probably not working together anymore. Anyway, stop that. There. Anyway, get back to my wonderful story.
Sorry.
Thank you. Now, as a woman, this is serious here. As a woman, I am concerned with the amount of abuse against other women on social media and in public and in private matter. My friends tell me stories as well, and I have witnessed and been subjected to my fair share of unwanted attention from both men and women. So I believe my section of our awesome podcast is needed at this time to shed light on these hatpin warriors. To begin, I will describe a hatpin for those who don't know. A hatpin is a long, thin piece of metal, usually silver, with an ornate object at one end to secure a gorgeous hat, and they were gorgeous, to one's head, usually through the hair. The hatpin era was from 1890 to 1925, where hats replaced bonnets and bonnet strings that were tied under the chin. Hatpins fell from favour in the Roaring Twenties as hair became shorter and large hats were no longer in fashion. The bigger the hats became, the longer the hatpins, until some were almost a foot long. Wow. If you can just think of a foot-long Subway.
Oh, boy.
That's the only thing I can think of. Okay. It was one of these almost foot-long hatpins that ended up getting stabbed into the arm of a man who, on May 28th, 1903, gave unwanted attention to Leoti Blaker, who was visiting New York from Kansas while they were riding in a carriage. The man, who Leoti described as, and I quote, elderly, elegantly dressed and benevolent looking, was jostled in the carriage from side to side with Leoti until he was hard pressed up against her shoulder and hip, and when he slung his arm along her lower back, she had enough by that stage, she took out her hatpin and plunged it into his arm, and he got off at the next stop, and he was apparently giving a big scream about it as well. Leoti said to reporters in her defense, and I quote, he was such a nice-looking gentleman, I was sorry to hurt him, she told the New York World. I've heard about Broadway mashers and L mashers, but I didn't know Fifth Avenue had a particular brand of its own. If New York women will tolerate mashing, Kansas girls will not, end quote. Now, it's the beginning of the time when women documented fighting off mashers. Now, It's a slang term of the time to describe, and I quote, men who made unwanted advances on women in public, end quote. The word masher was once a term used to describe a well-dressed, smart young man, but as more women were travelling without a male escort, some men thought they were easy prey, so masher became synonymous with unwanted advances. Now, soon other women were coming forward with their own stories of fending off alleged mashers. A woman tired of insulting questions, in quotes there, beat off a masher with an umbrella, another useful deterrent. A female teacher slashed the face of a masher with her hatpin, and a housewife on a streetcar fended off a masher who brushed up against her and asked if he could see her home. Oh no, very improper, especially if you're a married woman. It was a time when society began to stop seeing women as part of male property, be that of her father, brother, or husband, and dependence on males was dwindling to women wanting to think, fend for, and defend themselves. So it was that shift in public perception as well. Suffragettes and working women soon joined in the conversation, praising the need for women to move about freely, alone, and without harassment in public, and against mashers. The Chicago Vice Commission advised that women should not go out in public with ankles showing or cheeks rouged, so not to draw unwanted attention to themselves, a notion that was howled down by the suffragettes, who came back with it wasn't the fashion or freedoms that's the point, but the, quote, vileness of the masher mind, end quote. Others began to attack, not women's changing freedom of clothes, but to the hatpin itself, and calls to reduce their length began to circulate. Encounter stories from men who told of being threatened with a hatpin where they were advised that they were innocent. One woman playing with her boyfriend, she was playing and she was mucking around in the article I read, thrust her hatpin at him, stabbing him fatally in the heart, while another man on a streetcar felt a sharp pain near his ear. Which was an accidental prick of a hatpin, caused him to fall into a coma and pass away. Hatpin-wielding women at a New York factory upset at two of their colleagues being arrested for making alleged anarchistic speeches, attack police. Other women weren't exempt from being threatened with hatpins either. In Chicago, a woman and her husband's mistress drew hatpins, jewel-like, and began circling each other until the police came and broke it up.
That's an image.
That is a really, really interesting image. By 1909, the hatpin was known as an international threat, with police in Paris and Hamburg calling for the reduction in their length as well. In March 1910, and also in Chicago, this little city is obviously one of those pumping ones.
Hatpin Central.
The city council debated an ordinance that anyone caught with a hatpin more than 9 inches long would be fined $50. The proceedings were as follows, and I quote, "The proceedings were packed with curious spectators, men and women, and acrimonious from the start. If women care to wear carrots and roosters on their heads, that is a matter for their own concern. But when it comes to wearing swords, they must be stopped," a supporter said. Cries of bravo from the men and hisses from the women. Nan Davis, there to represent several women's clubs, asked for permission to address the committee. "If the men of Chicago want to take the hatpins away from us, let them make the streets safe," she said. "No man has the right to tell me how I shall dress and what I shall wear." Bravo, Nan! Love your work! Yay! I feel the same way. The law was passed at 68 votes to 2 in favor of shortening the hatpins. New Orleans, Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Milwaukee soon followed with similar laws. Closer to home in Sydney, Australia, women went to jail rather than pay the fines for their hatpin's length. London women refused to buy hatpin point protectors. So, yeah, they were defiant there too. The decline began in 1914 when metal was used for war requirements, not hatpins, and died out completely in 1925. Well, almost completely, because people are still making them. But the antique ones stopped around that time, when hair was cut in the bob style and large hats were no longer needed. So as hatpins have a beginning and an end phase, they became collector's pieces. I am thinking of collecting antique ones myself, and I saw this gorgeous one for over $1,000, but it was so pretty. And it was silver and filigree roses. And yeah, okay. And with that, I would have my own piece of What the History. Yeah, it was from the 1920s. It was really pretty.
Not that we, you know, pan for donations on the podcast or anything like that. No, we would never think of that.
I'm still waiting for my Sir Tristram Roses.
Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. But, I mean, this is one of the things I think where you know, things never change. I mean, for God's sakes, don't hassle women and they won't need to stab you with hat pins.
Yes.
I mean, for God's sakes, with people today going about how women dress, no.
Yes.
If you are someone who feels that they must molest someone for the way they're dressed, you are the problem, not them.
Woo! Huh. I love you.
Thank you.
That's exactly how I feel as well. Do not slut shame. Do not clothes shame. Do not fat shame. Do not shame anyone.
Don't unless they're hurting. Unless a dick.
Yeah. Rule number one, don't be a dick.
There we go.
Okay.
Rather serious moment on the podcast
there. Oh, goodness.
There.
Yeah. But it needs to be said, I think, in conjunction with this. It needs to
yes.
be said.
Yes.
Again
yes.
and again and again and again. And women will not stop saying it.
And
I know I won't. And I know my friends won't.
I will keep saying it too. And last time I looked, I wasn't a woman. So there you go.
Yeah. I love you. You rock.
Anyway, so as far as I'm concerned, these women are very heroic.
Mm-hmm. I believe they are too. They were starting to fight back and going, look, we're not going to take that sort of rubbish from these people who are telling us what to do and what not to do. We are our own people now.
Mm-hmm.
And yay, and fight back. Just don't harass people at all. Don't harass men. Don't harass women. Just don't be a dick.
Yeah, absolutely. And
please don't be a dick.
For as we can say, these women are wonders. These women are warriors. And that may of segue into our next story.
Oh, I see what you did there. That was really cool.
I actually did a smooth one for a change.
Oh, another jaunty one.
I think I've probably given
a jaunty angle.
No. Don't take me back to the Rufus Project podcast I just did. That movie was terrible, terrible. If you want to listen to it, check out the Rufus Project podcast.
On, what's it, Stash?
Battlefield Earth. Oh, boy. Let's talk about better things.
Yes, please.
I may have given it away, but we'll get
please.
There.
Please, yes, the segue was a warrior.
Yes, yes. So, iconic characters often come from fairly humble beginnings. But sometimes the story behind the story is more what the than you might expect. Such is the story of William Moulton Marston, the attributed creator of one of the most well-known superheroes around, especially at the moment.
Mm-hmm.
Born in 1893, he ended up going to Harvard University, where he obtained his PhD in psychology in 1921. His first claim to fame came due to research inspired by his wife, Elizabeth Holloway, who he had married in 1915, who stated that she felt her blood pressure rise whenever she got angry. William followed this line of thought and believed you could monitor for changes in blood pressure to see if someone was lying. This led to the creation of a lie detector test in 1915.
Woohoo!
At this point, I should mention that besides working together on the lie detector, Elizabeth and William were also both staunch feminists and both much inspired by the suffragettes and the associated imagery, perhaps even hat pins.
Perhaps even hat pins.
Yes.
It's around that time.
In 1925, William's life took quite a turn, one that would have been considered extremely shocking at the time and would most likely still raise a few eyebrows today. At the time, William was a senior lecturer at Tufts University in Massachusetts in the US of A. And amongst his students was another strong feminist, Olive Byrne, who was also the niece of Margaret Sanger, who in turn with Olive's mother Ethel opened and was subsequently arrested for the first birth control clinic in the United States. But back to the subject at hand.
These women. Awesome.
Yes. Olive was a very keen student. Very keen. So keen that she and William ended up in a relationship. In fact, William gave Elizabeth the ultimatum that if Olive was not able to live with them, he would leave. Elizabeth agreed, but only if she could continue working while Olive remained to raise children. Now, both women ended up having two children, fathered by William.
What an awesome relationship.
Now, yeah, I mean, look, it's fine. I'm happy with anything as long as everyone's happy. But in the 1920s, this arrangement was highly irregular and potentially illegal. Oh. So to cover themselves, when census takers came around, and anyone else who might have been curious, they claimed Olive was William's widowed sister-in-law. They stuck to the story so closely that the children were not aware William was their real father until the mid-1960s.
Yeah, that I don't agree with.
Yeah.
Tell the kids where they're from.
Anyway, now, at this point, I should also mention that Olive enjoyed wearing heavy, thick bracelets. And yes, that does have relevance. In 1940, William was hired by Maxwell Gaines, the founder of All American Comics, which had published stories that brought Superman into the public eye. However, with war in Europe impacting popular culture, many stories were very violent, to the point where the Chicago Daily published an editorial condemning the disgraceful books, going as far as saying, quote, 10 million copies of these sex horror serials are sold every month!
Oh no!
End quote. And calling for a ban of the comics to prevent, quote again, a coming generation even more ferocious than the present one. End quote. Maxwell had read an article about William's work in Family Circle magazine, a piece written by Olive under the pseudonym Olive Richard, who had visited, I hope you heard the air quotes there, William to discuss comics. Discussions between William and Maxwell led to the proposition that a female superhero, one that embodied the principles of feminism and the suffragettes, would help to turn the tide on comic books' bad press. Maxwell had one condition, though. He wanted William to write the script for his comic book Wonder Woman. Yes, that one.
Uh-huh.
He gave Wonder Woman, aka Diana Prince, a version of his and Elizabeth's lie detector, a golden lasso, to compel people to tell the truth. Her wristbands were inspired by Olive's love of heavy bracelets, and in many of the early comics, Wonder Woman would regularly be captured and chained. However, instead of having to wait for a savior, she would burst her bonds and regain her freedom, inspired by the imagery of women breaking their chains that was popularized by the suffragette movement. Even if this did lead to speculation that William, Elizabeth, and Olive engaged in BDSM as well as polyamory. For those who may be concerned about the ultimatums that formed the initial part of the relationship, Olive and Elizabeth continued to live together for nearly 40 years after the death of William in 1947, right up until Olive's death in the late 1980s. Elizabeth even named one of her children Olive. Mm. So, look, if you go see Wonder Woman on the big screen, you'll also be seeing aspects of the relationship that helped create her. While little is known about the day-to-day of William's, Elizabeth's, and Olive's relationship, now, this is a personal bit here, but I personally feel that the love they had for each other, it shows in Diana Prince's love for the world.
Oh, that is so beautiful.
So, yeah.
Oh, God.
And this also means that I can put Wonder Woman as a tag in our podcast description.
You can. You can. That was brilliantly written and brilliantly researched, and I'm really proud of that one, Trev. Well done.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well I do proud of that
That's
one.
That's beautiful.
And on that note, I feel that
I'm feeling really teary at the moment. Actually.
And I'm hoping that this podcast has been entertaining and also a little bit empowering for people as well. Look, go out there, be who you are, do what you do, just don't be a dick.
Yeah, and don't hurt people.
Exactly. And yes, on that note, on a normal little jaunty podcast, been a little serious tonight, and that
we
is
have been
fine.
Serious.
Yeah,
well, they are serious issues.
Yes, absolutely. And we hope that you have enjoyed listening. Now, if you want to know more about anything that we've talked about, we've got our references in the podcast description down below. Or you can even head to our homepage, wthpod.rufusproject.com. Where you, again, will find those references, and you can actually leave comments below this very episode. If you do want to get in touch with us other ways, you can find the What the History podcast Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
We're at pod_what on Twitter, or you can even search the hashtag WTHpod on social media, and you should get some sort of result.
from any of those
absolutely
avenues.
or... Or if you want, you can even send us an email if you want to be a bit more private, and that's fine too. And that is right. To WTHpod@rufusproject.com. We really would love to hear from you. Your thoughts, your feelings, your suggestions, anything at all, you know, we would definitely love to hear from you.
Absolutely. Tell your friends, tell your enemies, tell your cat and dog, birds, guinea pigs. Tell your guinea pigs.
Tell your local newspaper that they can write stories about us.
Yes. Tell the ABC. Mm. That would be interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, because I think we're not in the right genre for any of the commercial stations. So, yeah, ABC and SBS.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep, absolutely.
No, well, I'd be willing to go with that.
We'd talk to anybody, really.
Triple Z.
Yep. Yeah. We would talk to anybody
about
anything.
We like the goodies. We do.
No, we're not.
No, we're not like the goodies.
No.
And I'd just like to say the inspiration for Hatpin Warriors actually came from a friend of mine's post that she put up a few months ago on Facebook. So thank you very much, Rochelle. Love your work, babe. Keep going.
Woo! And I think we should probably wrap things up. I feel quite good about this episode.
I do. I feel really, really, you know, happy and empowered. And so many interesting people in history, and like what they did go on to shape what is still relevant today and is what is still current. Like, you know, for Wonder Woman and things like this, I've heard from so many people that they feel really good and really strong and empowered from both men and women after seeing Wonder Woman. It just goes to show she has such a global appeal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I love that golden lasso. I think that thing is awesome.
Probably should say that we're not sponsored by DC, Warner Brothers, or Wonder Woman.
We're not. We're just saying what we feel.
Absolutely.
And that's what we do at What the History. We say what we feel.
And we shall be back.
We shall.
In a couple of weeks' time with two more bizarre bits of history to make you say, what the history? See
what
you next
the
time.
History? Good night, everyone.
Bye. Bye.